Chapter 6. 13-year-old James B. Mann, Jr. stood with his father, squinting at the planes that circled high above their beach house at Haleiwa on the northwest coast of Oahu. The Manns liked to come to Haleiwa for a restful weekend, but this morning there was no rest at all. First, the planes set off their two pug dogs. Then the barking woke the family up. Mrs. Mann thought it might be that Lieutenant Underwood from Wheeler Field. He was always buzzing the beach. But Mr. Mann and Jr. quickly discovered that it was a much bigger show. More than 100 planes were orbiting about, gradually breaking up into smaller groups of 3, 5, and 7. Soon, several fighters dropped down low enough for Jr. to observe, "They've changed the color of our planes." Then the fighters sped off to the east, down the road toward Schofield and Wheeler Field. Now the other groups were flying away too, and by 7:45 a.m. they had all disappeared. 12 miles further south, another 13-year-old, Tommy Young, was surfcasting with his father off Miley Beach. Suddenly, Tommy's attention was attracted by the drone of airplane motors. Looking up, he saw a big formation of silvery planes flying southeast. His father counted 72 of them. 14 miles to the southeast, two other young fishermen were trying their luck in Pearl Harbor. 13-year-old Jerry Morton and his kid brother Don, 11, sat on the enlisted men's landing at Pearl City, a peninsula that juts southward into the middle of the anchorage. Like most service children, Jerry and Don regarded Pearl Harbor not as a naval base, but as a huge, fascinating play pool. Almost every morning when they weren't at school, they ran down to the landing, only 200 yards from the house, and let out a ball of string. Occasionally, a gullible perch took a chance, rarely anything worthy of the dinner table. But there were always the ships, the planes, the sailors, a wonderful kaleidoscope that never grew dull. This morning they set out as usual, barefoot, khaki pants rolled up, T-shirts stuffed in their pockets as soon as their mother wasn't looking. Little gusts of wind stirred the harbor waters, but the sun poked through the clouds often enough to make the day hot and lazy. It was a typical Sunday morning, except for one thing. Incredibly, the fish were biting. By 7:45, the boys had used up all their bait, and Don was dispatched to the house for more. Jerry, the senior partner, lolled in the morning sun. Around him, the ships of the Pacific Fleet lay in every direction. To the north and east, little nests of destroyers clustered about their tenders at anchor. To the southeast, most of the cruisers pointed into the Navy Yard piers. Still further to the south, the cruiser Helena lay at 1010 dock, then the battleship Pennsylvania, sharing dry dock number 1 with 2 destroyers. To their west was another destroyer high in the floating dry dock. And finally, completing the circle, more destroyers, the repair ship Medusa, and the aircraft tender Curtis lay moored offshore. Dominating the whole scene, and squarely in the middle of the harbor, was Ford Island, where Don and Jerry's stepfather, aviation ordnanceman Thomas Croft, had duty this Sunday at the seaplane hangars. The Navy PBY patrol planes were based here, also the carrier planes when they were in port. The carriers themselves moored along the northwest side of the island, while the battleships used the southeast side. This Sunday, of course, the carriers were all at sea, and the moorings opposite Pearl City offered little in the way of excitement. Only the old cruisers Detroit and Raleigh, the ex-battleship Utah, now demoted to target ship, the seaplane tender Tangier. But on the far side of the island, a thrilling line of masts and funnels sprouted from Battleship Row. Nevada, Arizona, Tennessee, West Virginia, Maryland, Oklahoma, and California were all there. Other less glamorous craft elbowed their way into the picture. The Honey Barge, YG-17, crawled from ship to ship collecting garbage. The tanker Neosia squatted toward the southern end of Battleship Row. The cruiser Baltimore, a veteran of Teddy Roosevelt's Great White Fleet, lingered in rusty retirement, anchored among the sleek destroyers in East Lock. The pokey little seaplane tender Swan perched on a marine railway near the cruisers. Radio operator Charles Michaels estimates she could do 12.6 knots with a clean bottom and all laundry aloft. The old gunboat Sacramento hovered nearby. Her tall, thin smokestack looked like something designed by Robert Fulton. The ancient mine layer Oglala lay next to the cruiser Helena at 1010 dock. She had the romantic past of a Fall River liner, but it was all over now. These days, she was almost always tied up, once so long that a family of birds built a nest in her funnel. The large and the small, the mighty and the meek, they all added up to 96 warships in Pearl Harbor this Sunday morning. Assembled together, the U.S. Pacific Fleet was a big family, yet it was a small family, too. Most of the men knew everybody else in their line of work, regardless of ship. Walter Simmons, who served a long hitch as mess attendant on the Curtis, recalls that it was almost impossible for him to board any other ship in the fleet without meeting someone he knew. In these pre-war days, everybody stayed put. Chief Bosun's mate Joseph Nixon had been on the San Francisco 9 years. Chief Jack Haley on the Nevada 12 years. Ensign Joseph Tausig, brand new to the ship, thought that several of the chief petty officers on the Nevada had been there before he was born. These old chiefs played an important part in keeping the family spirit. They were almost like fathers to the young ensigns, taught them beer baseball in the long dull hours when nothing was happening, called them Sonny when no one else was listening. But they were also the first to accept an officer's authority and believed implicitly in the Navy chain of command. For the officers, it was a small world, too. Year after year, they had come from the same school, taken the same courses, followed the same careers, step by step. They, too, knew one another's service records and signal numbers by heart. They all shared the same hard work, wardroom cokes, starched white uniforms, Annapolis traditions. Like all true professionals, they were a proud, sensitive, tightly knit group. But signs were beginning to appear that this small little world might be in for a change. Reservists were now pouring in from the various training programs. They were enthusiastic enough, but they lacked the background of Navy tradition. Where they were involved, sometimes the old way of doing things just wouldn't work. Doris Miller, a huge mess attendant on the West Virginia, was one of the regulars faced with this problem of reconciling the old with the new. Every morning, he had the colossal job of waking up Ensign Edmund Jacoby, a young reservist from the University of Wichita. At first, Miller used to yank at Jacoby, much like a Pullman porter arousing a passenger. This was fine with Jacoby, but an Annapolis man reminded Miller that an enlisted man must never touch an officer. Faced with the problem of upholding an ensign's dignity and still getting Jacoby up, Miller appeared the following morning with a brilliant solution. Standing 3 inches from Jacoby's ear, he yelled, "Hey, Jake!" and fled the room. This Sunday morning, Doris Miller had no problems. Ensign Jacoby was off duty and free to sleep. Miller was working as mess attendant in the junior officer's wardroom, but there were only 2 officers on hand and there wasn't much to do. It was just about as easy for the other men on duty. At 1010 dock, Coxswain Ralph Haynes was touching up the bright work on Admiral William Calhoun's gig. The Admiral, who gloried in the title Comtrainron 8, Commander Training Squadron 8, ran a group of supply ships. He had been scheduled to arrive this morning on the Antares, but for some reason was late. On the Nevada, Ensign Tausig was officer of the deck. He whiled away the time trying to think of something useful to do. It occurred to him that one boiler had been carrying the burden all 4 days the ship had been in port. He ordered another lit off. On the Arizona, Coxswain James Forbes had a working party on the fantail rigging the ship for church services. The awning flapped and snapped in the breeze, and standing on the shore waiting to go out, Fleet Chaplain William A. McGuire made a mental note to have an extra windbreak rigged to keep his altar things in place. But the sun was warm, the clouds were high, and all things considered, the day was perfect. Turning to his assistant, Seaman Joseph Workman, McGuire burst out, "Joe, this is one for the tourist." The men off duty seemed to agree. On ship after ship, they were getting ready to go ashore. Some, like Seaman Donald Marmon of the cruiser Honolulu, were preparing for Catholic Mass at the base arena. Others, like signalman John Blanken on the San Francisco, were headed for swimming at Waikiki. Ensign Thomas Taylor, on the Nevada, hoped to get in some tennis. The Helena Marine Detachment was warming up for softball. Ensign William Brown had a very special project in mind as he stood on the deck of his PT boat, which was loaded on the tanker Ramapo for shipment to the Philippines. His wife was coming over in 2 weeks, and he had just rented a little house in town. This would be the perfect day to fix the place up. The less ambitious loafed about the decks. On the St. Louis, Seaman Robert McMurray watched his mates playing checkers. Pharmacist's mate William Lynch on the California remembered this was his sister's birthday and began planning a letter to her. Machinist's mate R.L. Hooten sat on a bucket in front of his locker on the West Virginia, enjoying some snapshots just received from his wife. They were of his 8-month-old son, whom he had never seen.